from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Born in 1926, Fidel Castro, known mostly to the Cuban people as Fidel, died on Friday evening at the age of 90. We'll discuss the complicated life and legacy of the man who ruled Cuba for almost 50 years, through 10 U.S. presidents from Dwight D. Eisenhower to George W. Bush. Join us for the Forum program. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Fidel Castro, a guerrilla leader, came to power in the island nation of Cuba in 1959, overthrowing the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, one of the most polarizing figures in modern political history. Castro was loved by many of his fellow Cubans as a revolutionary leader who aligned himself with the workers and peasants of the island nation and brought major reform in areas such as healthcare, literacy, racial equity, and education. And he was detested and vilified as a brutal and ruthless despot, thief, and violator of human rights. And in this hour of Forum, we discuss Fidel Castro, his life, and his legacy. And joining us here in studio is Terry Lynn Carl, Gildred Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Emeritus of Political Science at Stanford University. Welcome to the program, Professor Carl.
Thank you.
And we also welcome to the program Tom Gelton, who joins us from the nation's capital, correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. Welcome, Tom Gelton.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you back with us. And we also want to welcome Lisa Garcia Bedoya, who is Chancellor's Professor of Education and Political Science at UC Berkeley and joins us by phone from the Berkeley campus. Welcome, Lisa Garcia Bedoya.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, if I may, because there's been a lot of talk about well, we heard earlier on NPR about Cuba and particularly in Havana, a feeling of mourning and solemnity and certainly a lot of talk about the ambivalence. I mean, because this was really the man who ruled Cuba for half a century. I'd like to explore that a bit with you. I mean, as a Cuban-American, you've said you feel mixed feelings.
Well, I guess I've been somewhat surprised by how emotional I feel, and I've come to realize that his figure loomed large in my life in the sense of changing my fate, changing the fate of my family. He was present at every family dinner, an object of both rage and sorrow in terms of representing the loss that my family felt. On the other hand, I know that my family in Cuba had different feelings about him and supported the regime and supported the changes that he brought. And so I'm trying to separate the emotional from the political, but definitely a huge figure for many and one that impacted so many lives in so many different ways.
Well, I know it's hard to separate those two, but it's also hard to separate politically because he did a lot of good. I mean, particularly with literacy and racial equity, the things I mentioned earlier, healthcare. But he also really brooked no quarter when it came to brutality.
Absolutely, and that's the fundamental contradiction. But I do think one of the things, I've been reading all of the different obituaries that were published over the weekend, and one of the things that I think it's really important to understand is that part of the problem was that the United States loomed so large in Cuban history up until the point of the revolution, if we think about the United States occupation and then the implementation of the Platt Amendment. And so for Cuba to have had the Nationalist Revolution that Castro said he was in support of, you had to have opposition to the United States, and that, you know, for a tiny Caribbean island with 11 million people required, I think, a level of sort of ferocity and sometimes brutality on his part in order to try to sustain that position.
And yet, Tom Gelton, there were 400 political enemies shot and executed after actually just being in office 90 days or being in power in 90 days.
Right. You know, Fidel Castro felt insecure about his hold on power in the immediate days after the revolution, and he and Raul Castro and Che Guevara did, in fact, go ruthlessly after anyone they considered their opponents. And, you know, and included some people who actually had welcomed his triumph. I know that the some of the police chiefs who sort of switched allegiances at the last minute before Batista fell and declared their allegiance to Fidel were seen as suspect or suspicious, and they too were executed, even though they had sworn their loyalty to the new government. So he was taking no chances. I mean, he really wanted to make sure that he extinguished all opposition to his rule in those first few months. And it's actually a story, Michael, that I don't think has gotten as much attention as it probably deserves, the number of people who were executed in Cuba in that first year.
And let's talk a little bit about the fact that early on, and even for about a couple years, roughly, after he had come to power, he said he was not a communist and was opposed to communism. He wanted democracy. In fact, let's hear a cut of Castro himself talking about what he represented until the Bay of Pigs.
There is not communism or Marxism in our idea. Our political philosophy is representative democracy and social justice in a well-planned economy.
And that was and continues to be a subject of great contention. Did Castro hide his Marxist-Leninism, which he claimed after the Bay of Pigs, 2 years later, after that invasion, because of the Cold War? Or was he all along a Marxist-Leninist? What's your take, Tom?
I think I don't think we're ever going to know the answer to that, because he has given inconsistent answers himself over the years. You know, there are many examples like the one you just played, where he declared that he was not a communist. He once said that communism solves the economic problems but suppresses freedoms the freedoms which are so dear to man. There are many examples like this. But on the other hand, in a 2003 interview, he said, in fact, he had been a communist all along and just felt the need to kind of keep it undercover. He said that he was actually the one who introduced Marxism-Leninism to his brother Raul. So now, was that just an opportunistic statement? You know, I think you never could tell with Fidel, you know, what his thinking was. And my guess is that we'll never know for sure what his private agenda was in the 50s.
But let me bring Terry Carl into this, who's here with us in studio. And Terry, it still becomes pretty clear that he wanted to not only create revolution in his own vision of what revolution was in Cuba, but also export it.
Well, I want to go back to one thing first. I think that when we talk about the 400 people that he shot, that it is extremely important to put this in some kind of context, because I have been working in Central America for many years, and where you have 75,000, 80,000 dead in El Salvador, where you have 250,000 to 300,000 dead in Guatemala. And so the nature of the Cuban Revolution, which has had so much play, and the brutality of Fidel Castro, is something that does have to be seen in some kind of context of the kinds of brutality that has gone on all over Latin America. That's not to say that those were not crimes by any means, but that this revolution, when you see what happens afterwards in the Southern Cone and other places, is relatively less violent and less brutal. It has had much more attention, however, because the way I see Cuba is as a civil war in which about a fifth of the population moved to Miami eventually and other places in the United States and actually waged the conflict from outside. And so because they're located in the United States in quite prominent places, that kind of violation of political and human rights has had a what I would consider a disproportionate impact, given the nature of what has happened all over Latin America. So I just...
Well, it was only 90 miles away, and there was fear, particularly in the missile crisis, that Castro was going to be pointing those missiles or seeing to it somehow that those missiles would be in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think what's really important, Michael, that you and I would remember, and this is for the generation that was affected mostly by 9/11, the very first time Americans felt threatened in the modern world that something was going to come and get us and attack us was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And people my age remember hiding under desks and trying to figure out how we were going to protect ourselves from nuclear missiles, et cetera. It was terrifying. It was terrifying in the way that 9/11 became terrifying for another generation. And in that sense, I think it's extremely important to understand why U.S. policy and Cuban policy is so fraught with the emotion that Lisa talked about. It isn't just Cuban Americans who had that emotion. It was the Kennedys. It was every president since. There is a irrational component and an emotional component to the relations between Cuba and the United States from the U.S. side, I would say, not just the Cuban, not just internally in Cuba and between Cuban Americans.
Well, Castro had some pretty strong feelings about the United States. I mean, exactly. They tried to kill him in so many different ways. He had a sort of a record for the number of assassination attempts.
637 assassination
right.
attempts.
And even when diplomatic relations were restored, he said, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with the empire and so forth. In fact, let's hear John F. Kennedy, says the Cuban Missile Crisis looms so central to Castro's legacy, what he said.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Notice that imprisoned island, and that's pretty much how he saw things. That is the President of the United States at the time, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Tom Gelton, let me go back to you because you've written a good deal about this, and we've certainly explored on the forum program the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically, but it was a big turning point.
Well, it certainly was, and I think one of the reasons that that the Cuban Missile Crisis was so pivotal in terms of shaping U.S. attitudes toward Cuba was precisely the attitude that Fidel Castro himself took during that crisis. I mean, there was very serious consideration in the White House given to invading Cuba. In fact, there were, I think it was only because John Kennedy and to an extent his brother Bobby took a stand against it that it didn't happen. There were very serious voices pushing for an invasion of Cuba at the time. And we now know that Fidel Castro wrote a cable to Nikita Khrushchev saying, urging him, pleading with him, that if the United States were to invade Cuba, that the Soviet Union should launch a nuclear strike against the United States. So, you know, the stakes were very high, and we're very fortunate that that crisis was resolved. But there was some very tough talk on the side of the Cubans there as well.
And let me go back, if I may, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, to you. I must tell you, when I was in Cuba, I felt the real burden of the poverty of that country. I mean, it was wretched and almost as bad as Haiti in many ways. But I was also struck by the fact that the people and the whole spirit of the people with respect to, I mean, they would tell you off the record and sometimes on the record that they suffered because they didn't have much incentive and it really affected them economically. You could make more money, you know, carrying somebody's suitcases or waiting on them in Cuba than you could if you were a neurosurgeon. But the reality also of what I saw was a spirited and extraordinarily people who were joyous, really. I mean, they're maybe mourning now, but they were joyous in the streets, celebrating music, dancing, and so forth. And the other thing that surprised me was you didn't see as much of Fidel as you did of Che Guevara, who was an Argentinian, in terms of revolutionary heroes.
No, that's absolutely true. But I think, again, to repeat what Terry said, I think it's really important to put these things in perspective and put Cuba within the perspective or the context of the Caribbean in terms of its economic development and appreciate that people do have access to education, which is not true in other countries of Latin America. People have access to health care, which is very important. And people have basic needs covered. You know, it may not be enough for people to eat, for example, what they get with their ration cards, but at least they are guaranteed something. And that is a big difference from the rest of the region. And so I think part of what you felt and what you saw, part of it is I think, an important part of Cuban culture, but it's also a reflection of the fact that there is a level of well-being because of those social supports being in place that is not always the case in other parts of Latin America. And so there is a great deal of support for the regime. There's also a great deal of frustration. I was just there in April, and the Cubans that I talked to, you know, felt that the Revolutionary Guard was old and that they didn't quite understand the changes in the world, and so people didn't want to give up the good that came from the revolution, but there is a sense that things need to change. But I think to appreciate that it's very difficult for a small country of 11 million people that's cut off from the major economic power of the hemisphere to have a level of economic development, you know, that you would expect you would see in Europe or in other places. So they do have other things to make up for that lack of income.
And Terry Lynn Carl, the embargo certainly made it very difficult economically for Cuba. There's no disputing that. But at the same time, we kept saying that this socialist nation, this imprisoned country, as John Kennedy called it, would somehow collapse. And even after the Soviet Union really pretty much pulled out, and the Soviet Union was propping Cuba up, let's put it bluntly, I think, Cuba stayed alive somehow.
You know, the extraordinary thing about Cuba, for someone like me who is a comparativist and works all over the world, is that in what they called the special period, when the economy just dropped through the ground. I mean, it was just extraordinary what happened overnight in Cuba. You would expect a collapse of a government, period. You would expect the kinds of collapses you saw in the former Soviet Union and all over Eastern Europe, that a regime could not stand that kind of economic collapse, the kind of economic collapse, by the way, that we're seeing in Venezuela today. And what you saw instead was that it didn't collapse. And I think that the main reason for that, and I would be interested to hear what your other guests said as well, is that the thing that Fidel Castro was such an expert in doing, and he was a towering figure in doing, is that he completed the War of Independence of Cuba. The War of Independence that José Martí started, the War of Independence that Theodore Roosevelt in the United States intervened on and essentially made Cuba a colony. And it was that
Plus the Platt Amendment was mentioned before, and we should outline that that was essentially the notion that the United States had essentially carte blanche to go in and intervene and occupy.
And could make Cuba essentially a colony. I mean, they made a White House. The first president of Cuba spoke English and was directed towards the United States. And Cubans were treated, as Luis Perez, who's a wonderful Cuban historian, says, were treated as children. And what Fidel Castro did, and what you saw even in the special period, and what I think you saw when you were there, Michael, is that he, using the nationalism of Cuba, he restored, and I wouldn't necessarily say restored, but he brought a kind of dignity and spirit to the Cubans that is undeniable when you're in Cuba. And it was undeniable even during the special period when I kept walking around going, how can people survive here? There was no food. I mean, people were hungry. I used to take my own family suitcases full of canned ham, you know, and I'm sure Lisa has many stories about this too, or other people do. It was an extraordinary period, and any other regime that I have ever looked at would have fallen apart. And the reason it didn't, I believe, is because of the nationalism of the revolution and because of the sense that is still in Cuba today, even with Raul, that no matter what you do in a transition towards a more market-oriented socialist economy, you must have a safety net for the very poorest. The other thing I think is there is that Fidel Castro and the revolution has created the seeds of its own change by educating its own population in a way that's truly extraordinary. If you go anywhere else in Latin America, you will not see a population that is so educated, that asks so many questions, that will literally assault you on the streets.
And yet
they
were living almost under conditions that are comparable to East Germany and the Stasi. I mean, they couldn't really express themselves freely because there was Tom Gelton. Yeah, let's hear from you.
Yeah, please. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the achievements of the Cuban government and with respect to health and education. There is no achievement that is remotely close to the achievement that this regime has stayed in power throughout all this time. And that is not only due to the nationalist appeal. I mean, you know, the vast, vast majority of Cubans supported Fidel when he came to power for precisely that reason. But he lost the support of a lot of people who were totally with him. And it was because of the repression that he introduced. I don't think there's any country in Latin America that devotes as high a percentage of its state budget to the state security apparatus, the secret police apparatus, the counterintelligence apparatus. Policemen on the street make more than doctors or teachers. The number one priority of the Cuban regime has been to stay in power, and they have devoted tremendous, tremendous resources to that goal, far more proportionally than have been devoted to health and education programs.
Well, now you're getting the picture, many of you, of the kind of mixed and multidimensional view that many of us have about Cuba under Castro's rule. I'd like to give an opportunity to those of you listening to weigh in here. In fact, invite you to do so in terms of not only Castro's life, but his legacy. Jose Marti was mentioned by Terry Carl, and he was a major influence on Castro, who, by the way, came from a landed family. I mean, he was from Spanish ancestors, but they had, like Che Guevara's family, they were essentially bourgeois and had a lot of property and so forth. And then he started taking over the land, and a lot of people left for Florida soon after that. We do invite your involvement in the program, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program again. Toll-free number to do that is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. We do invite, again, your involvement in the program. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, talking about the life and the legacy of Fidel Castro with Tom Gelton, correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Bicardi and The Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, who is Chancellor's Professor of Education and Political Science at UC Berkeley, and Terry Lynn Carl, who is here with us in studio, who is Gildred Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Stanford, and who has been really going to Latin America and Cuba all the way back to 1973. A lot of experience here with the panelists that we have, and a lot of certainly expertise when it comes to Cuba. And I mentioned Castro's roots, and he was born actually in the Oriente province of Cuba in 1926. He was imprisoned in 53 after leading an unsuccessful rising against the Batista regime. And just to give you sort of an outline or a skeleton, he was released from prison during an amnesty deal in 55, although sentenced for 20 years. And Batista later admitted that that was perhaps one of the biggest mistakes of his life or his ruling. And 56, with Che Guevara, the guerrilla war against the government began. Batista was sworn in. He was defeated, and it was sworn in as prime minister of Cuba in 59, and the Bay of Pigs was 61. I just wanted to get sort of a sense of the chronology there. It really wasn't until 76, though, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was 62, it wasn't until 76 that he was elected president by Cuba's National Assembly, although, as we've been saying, he was certainly in charge in every despotic way that any dictator might have been or might still be. And one of the big questions looming, and certainly like to hear from listeners on this, and we'll hear from our panelists on this, what now for Cuba under Raul Castro? He said he'll actually retire in two more years, and it no longer will be a family operation, one presumes. So what's up ahead for Cuba? What about Castro's legacy? What about his life? We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing Fidel Castro, his life, his legacy, the man, the myth, and certainly the legacy that continues in so many ways, and in ways that polarize and continue to polarize. Tom Gelton's with us, correspondent for National Public Radio and author of Bicardi and The Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause, and Lisa Garcia Bedoya, who is Chancellor's Professor of Education and Political Science at UC Berkeley, a Cuban-American, with us from Berkeley this morning. And Terry Lynn Carl is here in studio, Gildred Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Stanford. And as expected, comments are coming in here. Let me just read a few of them before I go to your phone calls. And again, you can join us a number of ways. You can join us by calling us 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or going right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Here are some strong comments. Tino writes, I just don't understand how so many respected people like President Obama can ignore Fidel's documented brutal history of mass execution. It doesn't matter what good Fidel has done if he executed his political enemies and held Cuba's citizens hostage. David writes, I'll remember Fidel Castro the same way I remember Hitler, Hussein, and Pol Pot. And Sean writes, Fidel Castro fought against an American-backed tyrant and against American imperialism. He outlived all the presidents who tried to kill him. His regime gave Cuba gender equality, first world literacy rates, excellent free health care, but none of that matters to Americans who only value the freedom of the 1% to exploit in the name of capitalism. Let's go to your calls. And we begin, Paul, with you from Sebastopol. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I seem to remember that they had a special out, Cuba, the Untold Story, on PBS on TV years ago, and they did it on NBC, and NBC cut to some commercials at some key points. With your panel of experts there, when did Fidel Castro come to try and meet with Kennedy in D.C. and get shunted from hotel to hotel with no phones that were working?
Well, actually, let me go to you on this, Tom Shelton. He came to meet with Eisenhower, and Eisenhower was on the golf course, is what I remember.
Right. That's right. His one and only visit to Washington was in April of 1959. He came, and Eisenhower wouldn't see him. He was too busy golfing to see him. He did meet with Vice President Nixon. At the time, the United States still had a fairly, you know, the United States switched sides at the very end. They could, you know, their intelligence people, the CIA in Cuba, by 1957, really recognized that Fidel's revolution was going to triumph. And he and his people, particularly in eastern Cuba, had very close relations with CIA personnel in eastern Cuba. And when he did come to power, the United States had a supportive view of him. I mean, he wasn't their first choice, but there was wide recognition that Batista had become a problem, a liability, that he was going to go. And as late as April, when Castro came to Washington, true, Eisenhower didn't want to meet with him, but there was still sort of a receptivity to him, partly because of all the statements that he made that he was not a communist and was determined to promote democracy in Cuba.
There was, Terry Carlin, you know, sometimes we confuse scenes out of movies with history, but there was a scene in The Godfather when Michael Corleone observed, and he was kind of shrewd about this, that there were Cubans willing to die for the cause of the revolution. And it stayed in my mind because I thought about people in ISIS and so forth and so many iterations of that, people willing to die for the cause. But the fact of the matter is Batista was corrupt and, you know, there was all this American Empire stuff that Castro has inveighed against. And so there were many Cubans who wanted to die for the revolution. It was Yankees no and Cuba sí.
Look, but Batista, when he left Cuba, took the entire national treasury with him, as did his government. A lot of that ended up, by the way, in Miami. And the first Cuban exiles in Miami were supporters of Batista. And what is really extraordinary about them is the way, because there was only about 5,000 of them that ended up in Miami, Cuba at the time, was the way that they were able in the 60s and 70s, 80s, and even in the 90s, to really exert hold over the a kind of political, cultural hold over all of the Cuban Americans in Miami and create the sense of Fidel Castro as the worst authoritarian government in Latin America. But I want to go back to something that I think we're going to see over and over again, and I agree very much with Tom about what he said about the authoritarianism of the Castro regime. But the Castro regime is a combination, which is why it's so polarizing, of the charisma of Fidel Castro, which no one else had in the same way, even Che Guevara, although the myth of him is much greater.
Or even Hugo Chavez.
No, not Hugo Chavez. Not anybody has been close to the kind of towering charisma that he could show. I used to watch him visit factories and see the results of, this is very early on, see how people flocked to him, how they just wanted to touch him. And in 1959, the CIA came out with a statement.
Excuse me, there was almost a messianic.
Yeah, it was messianic. If you met him, you could see why. Because, you know, here's a guy who landed on the grandma. Everybody he was with except a few people were killed. And he said, now we've landed, now we're going to win. He had like three rifles, I believe, and five people or something. And you're kind of looking at him going, are you nuts? And the combination of
charisma. Actually a dozen men, I think, who launched the revolution.
Right, you know, exactly. Initially. The combination of charisma, the nationalism that I spoke about, and the authoritarianism that Tom spoke about is what makes this story so complicated. And I think the other thing that makes it so complicated is it's so disproportionate. Cuba has exerted, it's a little island. There's 11 million people on this island. And it has exerted this extraordinary influence on U.S. foreign policy, on Africa, on Latin America, on the Middle East, it's way beyond anything you would ever imagine that a little island could do, way beyond something like Haiti, way beyond something like, you know, Trinidad or Jamaica. This is a Caribbean island. And that's what's so extraordinary to me about this story, and where I think you see the difference in your feelings, the feelings of different people about him, is which side of the coin you experience. Did you experience the charisma? Did you experience the nationalism and the benefits of the revolution? Or did you experience the authoritarianism of the revolution? And so much of that shapes how the emotion of this story.
Well, Lisa Garcia Bedoya was in Cuba for the first time just recently. And what was your sense, Lisa, particularly in light of the fact that Castro had been out of power for a decade? 2006, he relinquished to his brother Raul.
Well, I mean, there's a clear sense that things are changing. They're changing very slowly, and a desire for people for change. I did want to say, though, on the side of thinking about the authoritarianism, I actually did go for the first time during the special period. That was the first time I saw my family that's there, and I had the idea in my head that the repression of the regime was what people said it was. And so we were, you know, it was an evening, warm Cuban evening, and so the windows were open, and everybody in the room, about 20 family members, started complaining about the serious problems that were going on in the country at that time. And I got very nervous, imagining that some security forces were going to come and take people away. And I think the other brilliance of the regime is that they did allow people to express their personal opinions in that way. At the point at which they started, rounding people up or becoming more repressive was when people tried to organize into something serious. And so part of what allowed them to survive the special period, I think, was having that release valve of people complaining and being able to say what they thought, even if it was against Fidel himself. And so I think that it's no small thing that they managed to stay in power for that long. But I also think the last point is that all of this needs to be put within the context of Cuban history more broadly. And it's not that Fidel Castro came in on top of some utopian democratic history. Cuba had one free and fair election between 1902 and the revolution. Batista was not only corrupt, he was also brutal. He killed many people. He tortured many people. And Machado, also brutal. I mean, so it's not that you didn't have a history of brutality in Cuba, which is not to forgive what Fidel Castro did, but I think putting it in the context of a country that had a lot of difficulties, you know, having the sort of democratic openness that people, you know, wish that the country had had, and much of that had to do with the influence of the United States and the influence of U.S. companies and U.S. production at that time, and that was the thing, the point at which the United States started feeling much more negative about his regime was when the agrarian reform happened, and you actually had companies like United Fruit starting to lose their land. So I think putting that story in that broader context and appreciating the status of the Cuban economy and Cuban politics at the time of the revolution helps to explain the longevity of the regime.
And we will take more calls. Let me go to Michael next. Michael, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm particularly interested in hearing more about the trade embargo that we've had against Cuba, and in particular how it has limited the economy of Cuba, for decades, and also how it has kept medicine from the Cubans themselves.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. Let me go to Tom Gelton.
Well, medicine is not subject to the embargo, so the embargo does not explain the lack of medicine in Cuba. Also, food sales are allowed to Cuba. In fact, the United States is one of Cuba's largest trading partners, and most of that is in the area of agriculture. I mean, clearly, when you block trade in all its aspects between two countries that have been historically as close economically as Cuba and the United States, it has a deeply disruptive effect on the economic development of that country. But I think it's pretty well documented that the central planning model that the Cubans have followed for the last 50-some years has contributed probably more than the embargo to the economic problems in that country.
Tom, it was crazy. I have to tell you, when I was there, they were importing sugar from Vietnam. I
mean, right, exactly. I had one other quick point that I want to make. So Terry talked about the charisma of Fidel, which I think is absolutely correct. There is a flip side to that, however, which is that when you build a revolution on the charisma of one leader, you're not really establishing the foundation for the sustainability of that revolution. And one of, I think, Fidel's great failings was he didn't really seem to put a very high priority on developing a genuinely collective leadership or the institutions that could survive him and Raul. I mean, even the Communist Party in Cuba has always been under the personal control of Fidel and Raul. And, you know, I mean, if you're a Cuban who cares about the future of the revolution, I think that you have not been well served by these leaders who have so personalized the power of the revolution in their own personas and really not put much of an emphasis on the development of institutions that could carry that forward.
Yeah, someone once said even Putin has a Politburo that he supposedly has to at least somewhat respond to, if not answer to. Actually, let me go to you on this, Terry Carroll, because I'm going to comment from a listener. Actually, it's a question from Rhonda, who says, you've talked about the past in Cuba. What about going forward? What will Fidel's brother do to set Cuba on a path of prosperity for the Cuban people, which ties right in with what Tom just said?
Yeah, I think that what Tom said is very true, but I think that you shouldn't lump Fidel and Raul together. I think that what we're seeing with Raul Castro is very different.
It's more pragmatic.
Well, it's not just more pragmatic. He is very aware that Fidel did not institutionalize and that his oversized figure from the charisma aspect really got in the way of institutionalizing anything. So what he's done and what has been happening actually as Fidel got sicker and got less present in the government, became less present. Remember, we haven't even seen him hardly in 10 years. So for the last 10 years and now, what we see is the absolute priority to trying to institutionalize the organizations of government. Now, it may not be an institutionalization that Democrats like because it is a one-party system. But what Raul is actually doing, and in a very important way, I think, is transitioning from a charismatic figure who moved people up and down in the government based on their loyalty to him, based on whether he was impressed with them. He's removed those figures in very key ways, and he is bringing in people who are professional politicians, if I can put it that way, in many of the same ways we see in other governments, who have real experience. If you're going to be, for example, he said, if you're a doctor and you're going to be the minister of health, you better have practiced medicine. If you're an engineer and you're going to fix things in this country, you better have had history of fixing things. Now, that's not Fidel's style. That's Raul. And what you see is also that in the process of institutionalizing, this is one of their big challenges, is can they move from what Tom described to a more institutionalized setting? And in the process of that, what you're seeing is, at least in the Communist Party, not so much in the government, you're seeing also new, younger people arise who are much more gender balanced. There's 42% of the Communist Party now is female, much more racially balanced than anything that existed before. And part of this is the effort to create an institutionalized government. Raul says he's stepping down in 2018. Nobody's ever said that in Cuba in a very, very long time.
He's also talked about passing the baton on to the man who is now vice president in Cuba. But the reality is that there's more of an economic model of China here, at least in Raul's mind, it would seem. But let me bring more of our callers in, and let's go next to you. Phil, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. My question really is around corruption. So I grew up in Miami, and what people forget is that gambling wasn't legal in Florida. So there would be ships that would take you the 90 miles across the street to Havana to gamble, and that Cuba was full of mafia. And when, you know, they got kicked out and Batista left, all that money came into Miami. And, you know, Castro had a hard on against corruption. I'm curious how that played out in the country.
What do you think, Lisa Garcia-Bedoya? Let me go to you on this.
Well, at a minimum, you don't have – Cuba's no longer the playground of the U.S. rich like it was before. Many people small factoid, you know, Lucy McGillicuddy met Desi from I Love Lucy, you know, in the story on the show. She met him on the junket to Havana with her girlfriends. And so that idea that you would go to Cuba and play and do things in Cuba that you wouldn't do otherwise and come home, that is not the case anymore. And this is one of the reasons why there were concerns with the development of tourism, that would corrupt – the revolution, and it's true that there's still the fact that there is this dual economy, some based on dollars, some based on the national currency. That is something that still needs to be resolved. It's been a problem since the special period, but tourism does not look the way it did in the 1950s for very specific reasons, because that has been such a concern of the regime.
And let me thank Phil for his call and read a tweet from Miami of a listener listening to us in Miami. He says, here in Miami, all we hear about is how bad and brutal Castro was. It's blasphemous to speak anything positive of him. And let's go to another caller. And John, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for broadcasting. I went to Cuba several times before 2010, thoroughly enjoyed everything. The one thing that I never could understand, and perhaps you or your callers could help me, was the amount of racism that I saw throughout Cuba. Whenever I was with a black friend, there were problems. And the blacker, or darker you were, the more problems there were in hotel accommodations, restaurants. Black Cubans were afraid to even go to certain parts of Havana or Cienfuegos. I'm wondering how you explain that.
Well, let's take this up because it remains another big controversy, Tom Gelton. I mean, Castro is often given kudos and props for bringing blacks more into a serious role in Cuba, in today's Cuba. And certainly you do feel a kind of integration when you walk through the streets of Havana. But at the same time, a lot of the more servile roles are still those taken up by people who are black.
Yeah, it's a mixed picture, Michael. I mean, one very important thing to keep in mind is that the majority of the population, the CIA actually puts it at, you know, 60-70% of the population is Afro-Cuban. So it's not as though this is a, you know, a white island with an African Cuban, Afro-Cuban minority. That's why, you know, the Cuban sort of human culture is very much a Caribbean culture. It very much reflects the contribution of the Afro-Cuban population. I think what is true is that at the leadership level, and there are many, you know, statistics about this, if you look at the composition of the Politburo or the Central Committee, it's overwhelmingly white. So it is true that Afro-Cubans are not well represented at the very highest levels of the Cuban government. But, you know, I'm not sure that there is the kind of overt racial discrimination that we have seen in this country. In fact, Cuba was, you know, one thing that is important for historians to recall is that the Cuban War for Independence was not only for independence, it was also for an end to slavery. And the majority of the Cuban Revolutionary Army in the 19th century was black. And they were just as important, more important to them, was fighting for an end to slavery as opposed to fighting for independence.
And one thinks of Haiti in that context, too. And let me thank John for his call and go next. Tony, to you. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to say I think it's important for Americans to look at Castro as someone who's more complex than either a hero or a villain. Ultimately, though, we hear so much of him being a villain. I think it's very, very hypocritical, given our relationship with different dictators in Latin America. I mean, ultimately, we don't care about murderers. You can look at Luis Posadas Carriles, the Cuban-American terrorist who we harbored and trained, who's probably celebrating in Miami right now. We don't care about murderers. We just care about the ones that are bad for business, and that really upsets me.
All right, we'll let that comment stand. Tony, thank you for it, and we'll go to another comment along, well, similar strong opinion lines. Jerry, you're on. Morning.
Yes, good morning. I want to speak for a family friend of ours. I grew up in Miami. I'm a 60-year-old man. I grew up in Miami, native of Florida, watched all the missile crisis issues and all that stuff. But the Parra family in Miami, good friends of ours, my dad was a Pan-American employee, and so we knew the Caribbean very well. My father and mother loved Cuba. And, you know, I'm not going to take a political side on this. I just want to speak for Carlos Parra, a gentleman that was pulled out in front of his family out of the house, and my friends, his sons, watched them execute his father. And I just want to speak in tribute to Mr. Parra and tell you that I have great dislike for the fact that we're paying tribute to men like this Castro guy who just are murderers. And that's when they cross that line for me, it's over.
All right. We thank you again for your opinion. And let me go to a question and go to you on this, Terry Carl. Christine writes, I'd love to hear about thoughts of the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela, and particularly since Hugo Chavez took power. Over the past 16 years, Venezuela has been subsidizing Cuba with free oil. Venezuela is now in deep poverty. Cuba, however, appears to be abandoning Venezuela and becoming more open to dealing with the United States. Seems like the Castros have been extremely smart politically, conveniently changing alliances to stay in power.
Cuba's foreign policy, and this is in general, has always had a realpolitik side, if I can put it that way. It's not just about ideology. For example, in the relationships with Mexico, Cuba and Mexico had a deal. We won't mess in your internal affairs between both of them. We won't get involved in your internal affairs, and we will both support each other in standing up to the United States because both of us have the same problem, which is poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States, so close to a hegemon. So that's always been their foreign policy. That's not a change. And it's led to some what I would consider extremely unfortunate things, such as the 1968 support of the invasion of Czechoslovakia by with their then ally Russia. But it's also led to standing up against even some of their allies, which you see in Africa, in certain actions that the Cubans took in Africa. In the Venezuelan case, to just answer your question, I think there's two really important things here. One goes back to the racism question. Venezuela, Cuba, Brazil, much of the Caribbean are mixed societies in which most of the people are not what would be considered white by white Americans in the United States. And what Cuba did, which is really important for countries like Venezuela and Brazil, is they removed certain kinds of legal restrictions on racism. But as we know in the United States, you can remove legal restrictions on racism and you have attitudes that go on and on and on until generations change. And so the reason I'm saying that is that part of the attraction for the Cubans in Venezuela, in the Andes countries where the leaders are indigenous peoples, was creating a network of not just white leaders in Latin America. And that is a problem all over Latin America, by the way. That's not just a Cuban problem. And so part of the attraction with the Venezuelans, the Hugo Chavez story, is that Hugo Chavez was not white. Hugo Chavez spoke for mixed race people in Venezuela. And if you didn't get that, you didn't get some of his appeal. Now, having said that, the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela was very much, if I can put it this way, the Cuban Doctors Without Borders foreign policy, which is the Cubans sent hundreds and hundreds of doctors all over Venezuela. I saw them everywhere when I was in Venezuela, to treat people who had never before had medical care in Venezuela. And in return, this is not an equal exchange. I'm not saying that. But in return, they got oil. Venezuelans don't have any oil to give Cuba anymore. Venezuela is a collapsing society right now. And in that sense, there is very little that Venezuela can do for Cuba. On the other hand, Cuban doctors are still in Venezuela. So there's both an ideological, a realpolitik side, but also this very strong sense that some of these countries are changing racially in their racial makeup, but in the way race plays itself out in power issues in Latin America as well.
Let me get another caller on here. Matt, you're on.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment that I think most of the what I hear in the media about Castro, most Americans have a blind spot and not, and you guys aren't talking about the CIA's role in whenever a anti-American or leftist government has come to power, the CIA has used political openness and opposition political parties or trade unions to overthrow the democratically elected leftist government.
Yeah, Matt, we're coming up on the end of time here, and I'm glad you brought this up because I'm looking at a comment from another listener. It says Davis is the listener. It should be remembered there was a history of the CIA involvement in undermining democratically elected governments in Central America at the time. Castro was faced with the real possibility that the U.S. would interfere with any democratic elections in Cuba. Want to comment, Tom Gelton?
Well, as I said before, the CIA and the U.S. government actually supported Fidel Castro when he first came to power. There were many plans to assassinate him. I really have to be skeptical about the figure of 637, which comes from Fidel himself. The vast majority of those were not attempts, but actually machinations, which were never really seriously pursued. But, you know, I can't, if you look at the CIA's role in history across the world, you know, it's important to take that seriously, and the power that they have had and the record they have had of overthrowing democratically elected governments. There's no question about it.
Let me thank Tom Gelton of NPR and Lisa Garcia Bedoya of UC Berkeley and Terry Lynn Carl of Stanford. And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. In the second hour this morning, we're going to meet Richard Blum, major philanthropist and investment financier guy. And stay tuned for that. Also husband of Dianne Feinstein. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.